Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do departures and conclusions mark the course of our lives? And how do we make meaning of these major changes in our physical surroundings, our professional goals, even our personal identities? My guest today has long been interested in the effect of our leave takings, both large and small, and why we tend to diminish their importance in our lives in favor of a relentless focus on beginnings, which strike us as somehow more auspicious and worthy of celebration. MacArthur Prize-winning sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is Emily Hargrove's Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard University. Her new book is called Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here again.
There are so many different kinds of exits and endings in our lives. What do they tend to have in common?
Well, oddly, they tend to have the fact that we neglect them. We don't pay much attention to them. We consider them often the negative spaces in our life journeys, moments of retreat, even moments of failure. So in some ways, I say that mostly they are invisible to us, particularly if we contrast them to the way in which we pay attention to and celebrate and honor launchings, beginnings, embarkings. So I think that's the primary way in which they look alike. We don't see them.
And it's interesting to me that sometimes an exit is almost indistinguishable from a beginning. An ending is the ending of one thing is the beginning of another, and we focus instead, as you mentioned, on the beginning of that other thing.
Right. And I think we, therefore, often don't make good beginnings because we haven't made good use of the moments of exit. We haven't used them as moments for reflection, generativity, propulsion, ways in which we can bring attention and honor to those moments that might, in fact, inform a better beginning afterwards.
Talk about this. You write that with some important exceptions, the very history of the United States has been defined by exits.
That's right. I mean, it is, and there are exits all around us. I mean, they are in our physical landscape all the time. They're the bright red flashing exit signs in movie theaters. Flight attendants point to the exits that we need to leave in order to be safe in case there's a terrible accident. There are exits all the time in our own developmental identities. You know, that Eric Erickson, one of my most favorite developmental psychologists, traced the life stages from birth to death. And he talks about the fact that at each of these life stages, there is a kind of a crisis, a kind of a tension between progression and regression. Mm. And the fact is that in order to move on to the next step, in order to propel ourselves forward, in order to evolve as human beings, we need to exit. And it's better if we exit well in a noticeable and thoughtful way.
In your personal life, some of the strongest memories you have are tied to exits, in particular moments when you decided it was time to make a change.
Right. I think one of the reasons I was so compelled to write this book is sort of my own experiences of exit. And all of the protagonists in my book have had this experience as well. The moment when finally all the forces come together in a perfect storm and we almost feel as if we have no choice. This is a bold, edgy moment where we say to ourselves, I'm out of here. Hmm. And this, I call these bold exits. I mean, moments of clarity. There's no longer any opaqueness. There's no longer any kind of ambivalence. We say it is time to leave. This happened when I was going through a very painful divorce and had found it very, very hard to leave the marriage. And at that moment, it happened as well when I decided to leave doing the kind of work that scholarship that I had been doing at Harvard and take on a new kind of methodological innovation that I had pioneered myself, and everyone said, this is crazy, don't do it. That moment when I said, no, I'm out of here, I must do what I must do.
I suppose in that case, the exit is really defined not as the entire process necessarily, but that moment when you shut your eyes and leap off the cliff.
Exactly. I make a distinction, as does everyone who talks to me in this book, between the sort of this moment that's very clear. It's as a matter of fact, if you ask people about these moments, they can tell you what they were wearing, they can tell you what they said, they can tell you what day of the week it was. It's that clear and memorable. it's like an old Polaroid photograph. But compare that to the other kinds of exit, which people refer to as iterative and messy and blurred. So before we ever get to that moment of bold clarity when we say we're out of here, there are moments preceding that all along the way where we're making these kind of moves towards exit, these iterative steps towards exit. And it's even true that once we've made the bold move, I'm out of here, that there are these aftershocks of exit where we kind of, again, experience, did we do the right thing? What, can we move forward? Do we have the courage? Do we have enough faith as well?
Yeah, it's like if we're waiting to not have any second thoughts, nothing will ever change.
Nothing will ever change. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right.
So in the chapter in which you write about exits as freedom from, say, a decision to leave what is not working, the obvious example is, as you mentioned, people leaving marriages. But you have this fascinating story of a family that finally came to the decision that they needed to help their son escape like this tortured history of bullying at school.
Yes, this was a little boy who was from a family, is from a family who's Iranian, and his mother was a first-generation immigrant, and she and her husband have been relatively successful. They bought a house in the suburbs, and they bought the house there because they wanted their children to have excellent schooling. And this little boy, in fact, loved school every bit. That you could love school. He loved to read. He loved to write. He knew several languages even before he entered school, and he couldn't wait to get to school. And when he entered kindergarten, it was just weeks. It was actually the fall of the 9/11 attack in Lower Manhattan. And the first day he entered school, Ricky and his gang of kids, who were only 5 and 6 years old, began to bully him and make him be their soldier and tell him to fight, fight, fight. And this little Isan was a very quiet, somewhat timid, reticent boy, not very athletic, who was absolutely not a fighter. And he was bullied from the very first day he arrived at school and terrified by this, physically hurt by it, emotionally hurt by it. And for, in fact, 5 years until he reached the fifth grade, his family tried to protect him, support him, help him. They met with teachers. They met with principals. They put him in counseling, judo lessons for self-protection. Nothing worked, but it was very, very important for him to continue to try, and his parents to continue to try to be in this school, because this is what they had wanted all along for their child, and this is what he wanted for himself. So there were moments of real clarity where it was clear that, I mean, that he was, it was too much. The violence was much, much too much. But after being bullied for a very long time, you know, the victim begins to, in some ways, think that he is who the bullies are making him into.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very sad, very painful transition where you begin to, in some ways, identify with the abusers, you as victim.
Well, what is so poignant about that story is that after it's all over and his parents decide that they will homeschool him and things look somewhat better after that, they ask themselves, why did we wait so long?
Exactly. I mean, they wonder, why did we wait so long? And I think in this case, the mother discovers, and this is a discovery that she makes in having a conversation with me, actually, that she was bullied as a young child going to school, that her father always said, this is the bargain you make with being an American. You suffer in order to be in this wonderful country. And so don't whine, but just keep going. And she sort of inherited that view, and she passed it on even very subtly to her young son. So she feels as if she tolerated this, even though she was in so much pain and her son was in so much pain, partly because this is the way she was raised as a first-generation immigrant.
And they had to come to that understanding that this was not quitting. This was about making a change in order to continue the boy's education.
I mean, she says that, in fact. She says this incredible line. She says, we are not quitting. We are done. And it's, I think one of the things that's so amazing about this chapter on freedom is that all of those of us who are mothers and fathers, even if our children are not bullied, this process of trying to protect them from whatever the dangers and abuses are out there, we go through this process of how much autonomy to give them, right? What's best in terms of protecting them from these dangers and abuses. And so although this is a very extreme example, I think all of us experience this to some degree or the other.
A moment ago, Sarah, talking about this mother, you used the word discovery and the thing that she discovered in talking to you. And that's another common thread throughout this book. Every story you have here ultimately is a tale not only of an exit or an ending, but of someone really learning something about themselves and the nature of their relationship to the world.
Exactly. That's one of the things I think that's exciting about the process of doing the research and writing the book, is that I sit face to face with these folks hours and hours and hours talking about something which most of them haven't thought very much about, because most of us don't think much about exits. As a matter of fact, we're taught in school and we're taught at home to begin the story at the beginning.
Mm.
And then there's a middle and then there's an end. But to ask folks to focus on an exit gives them a reframing of their life stories that leads to discoveries that they had never imagined or thought of before. Epiphanies often.
What kinds of questions do you need to ask in order to get to the truth of stories like these? Are they different from the sort of research you would do for other projects?
Not really, because I think the fewer the questions, the better. The more attentive the listening, the deeper the curiosity. So one of the things that you're always working with in talking to people about these, and as you know from reading the book, there are a lot of painful stories in this, lots of struggle, lots of ambivalence, lots of difficulty, that once a person begins to tell the story, you let them tell it in the way they want to tell it. And I think the other thing is that you are always asking for details. The story resides in the specifics, and the specifics ultimately and the particular help us discover the universal. That's the magic of storytelling. So the only thing I would likely press on is for specifics. And people really, once you give them an opening, and let them, in some ways design the arc of the story, they're amazing in providing and seeing the details.
Is it obvious to you, even when the people you're working with haven't articulated it, when they're discovering something for the first time?
It's sometimes not obvious until I listen to the tapes again and and go over them and kind of reread them. But often people announce their discovery. They will say, I never thought about that before. This is the first time I'm telling this to anyone. That kind of thing. And even some people will say, play that tape back. I never knew I was that smart. In other words, they hear themselves tell the story. They ask me to stop the tape. They want to hear their voice saying it again.
Yeah. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is my guest. She's the MacArthur Prize-winning sociologist and Emily Hargroves Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard, who is also author of the new book, Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. If you have the story of an exit or an ending in your own life that you'd like to share, or if you have a question, we would love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is MacArthur Prize-winning sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. She's Emily Hargrove's Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard and author of the new book Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Another fascinating story in the book, Sarah, is that of Andrew Connolly, who over years came to terms with his identity as a gay man. And for him, the exit from his original expectation or that of the people around him that he would live a heterosexual life was less like walking out a door than peeling back the layers of an onion, which is such an interesting way to look at a major transition in life.
Right. I mean, he uses that metaphor in order to convey, that is peeling away the layers of an onion, in order to convey how exiting, as he puts it, is not binary. It's not that one day you are out of the closet after being in the closet, but that it is a staged process. It is iterative, and you come out to different groups of people who you relate to very differently. He also makes the point that he is a gay rights activist, and so is very, very engaged in the struggle with his comrades, that coming out publicly is much easier than coming out privately. Particularly for him, the hardest coming out was with his parents, who were working class, Irish, Catholic, Democrats who lived in Worcester, Massachusetts, and who always expected that their son would be a priest. Hmm. He became, in fact, an educator, very involved in public policy as well in Washington. He worked for the Clinton administration. And with all of that coming out, what was hardest was that his parents were unwilling to engage him in a conversation. They, in fact, silenced the conversation every time he wanted to bring up the fact that he was gay. They didn't want to hear about it. They refused to attend his partner's funeral, who died of AIDS at 35 years old. And so that was the most painful and difficult private exit, intimate exit, much harder than the public exits he made as an activist and as a political actor.
Yeah, and that refusal on their part to go to the funeral was a much bigger deal for him than the fact that they couldn't accept that he was gay.
That was. I mean, that was and he also felt badly because he kept on feeling they are no longer alive. I wish I had pushed further. You know, I let them off the hook. So there was some big regret in that. But on the other hand, what's really interesting about Andrew's story is that he had a very happy childhood. He had the unconditional support and love of his parents, who thought he was the greatest guy. And he really feels as if he wouldn't have had the strength, the courage, the tenacity to emerge from the closet were it not for that unconditional love that his parents provided when he was a child.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it stands to reason that if most exits are ultimately about relationships, they're going to be just as messy, just as varied, just as imperfect in many cases.
Exactly, exactly. And it, in some ways, this story of his establishing identity and finding himself and becoming true to himself and becoming an authentic person and moving away from the parental home and from that set of values, that's kind of the universal story, isn't it, for all of us, that in order for us to become who we truly are as independent beings, authentic to who we are, we do often have to go some distance from where our parents were.
And sometimes remaining authentic to who we are means we must change throughout life. And you have the story here of Teresa Russo, who had this sort of really long departure from an organization which she founded, which she felt like was her entire identity, and which she ultimately realized they were no longer the right fit for one another.
Right. She realized she had started this organization, was the founder, grew it for 25 years, but then realized that if this organization was going to continue to grow, and as she puts it, not be personality-driven, but theory-driven, then she needed to get out of the way. She needed to leave. She also realized that at 58 years old, she had one last shot to really change her life and really do something big in terms of her work life and her personal life. So it was time for her to leave as well. And so she staged her exit in a very kind of thoughtful, ritualized way. She made the transition to a new leader of the organization. And once she had done that, she felt terrible. She was surprised at how marginalized she felt and how painful this exit was. And so her story really points to the fact that even when we have the choice, even if this is an explicit decision we make, and even if we go about it in the most sort of efficient and thoughtful and clear-minded way, with our eyes wide open, we may be blindsided by how much of a loss this feels like, you know, how much pain goes into leaving something before we can experience the feelings of liberation.
Well, and I guess it takes us all by surprise that even if we know intellectually that something or some organization or some series of relationships will move along just fine without us there, we almost want to think that everything's in chaos when we step out.
That's right. We want to feel as if we're irreplaceable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we would never say that. Teresa was, you know, had her PhD in organizational development. She had intellectually completely understood what this meant and why she needed to leave this organization. But that's very different from the emotional level of turmoil when we need to make the retreat that still feels like a huge loss.
And her leave-taking from the organization was by choice. She was able to set it up the way she wanted. But then her sort of other career, the one at which she earned her living, the rug was pulled out from under her at around the same time in the way that fate sometimes will do to us.
Yes, she was. She was a professor at a university, and she was working half-time at both of those positions. And as a matter of fact, she was enjoying more and more the kind of role of being a professor, mentoring students, doing research, writing articles and books, enjoying the kind of, as she put it, solo voice of an academic who's able to say what's on her mind, rather than the more collective voice that's part of a nonprofit organization. But just as she was saying goodbye to the nonprofit organization, she got the word that she had been cut because of restructuring in her department from being a professor at the university. And so it was a double whammy. And as a matter of fact, it felt worse because she had no choice in it.
Is it necessary for our self-esteem, for our sanity, to find ways to always discover something positive in every exit in our lives?
I think it's a good practice. I think that every transition, even if it feels brutal and even if it feels hard and difficult and painful, there is, and I don't mean to be kind of rhapsodic about that, but there is a silver lining. There is some thread of experience that you can learn from, some thread of experience that might be freeing, might be liberating, and might force us to sort of see the world and our path in a different way. And it's useful to really look for that as we make the transitions, which is one of the things that reasons that I think we need to pay deep attention to exits is because there are those revelatory moments where we discover, you know, there's something in this, even though it isn't feeling good at the moment, there's some promise, some potential in this.
So we all have exits in our personal lives and our professional lives, but for some people, the nature of their professions requires them to constantly be sort of looking ahead to the exit that they will take. And there are anthropologists in the field and psychologists with their patients. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned about how people navigate sort of planning for an eventual exit from the lives of people you've become quite intimate with?
Right. Well, one of the stories is of an anthropologist who's worked for 4 years with Mexican-American mothers in Denver around their learning how to do community organizing for their children's schools. And she spends 4 years getting to know these mothers, documenting their life stories. And documenting, of course, is very important to these newly arrived Mexican-American mothers. Documenting these stories, listening to them, and really getting to know them in a very deep and intimate way. And one of the things that I know from being a social scientist who's done a lot of this kind of work in the field is that most of us are trained to pay attention to our entry into the field. Hmm. Anthropologists call it gaining access, right? So we work very hard to build relationships with folks in the field, to develop levels of trust and communication, to be both participants and observers, and finally, we ask them the hard question, are you willing to participate? And then we begin to document their lives. But most of us are not trained at all to pay attention to the exits. We just kind of leave,
yeah.
You know. And people who are left behind rightfully often feel abandoned. I mean, some people even describe it as feeling like a rape. You've come, you've shuffled through my drawers, you've stolen everything that's precious to me, and you're taking it away.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that this anthropologist whose story is in the book talks about is learning that it was just as important and just as tender and just as treacherous to do a good job of leaving as it is to do a good job of entering. And so she really does stage her exit. She lets the people with whom she's built the relationships know when she's leaving. She begins to have those conversations of departure. She lets them read pieces of the documents that she's prepared that show what she was looking at and how she's describing them. And she, interestingly enough, begins to reveal much more about herself. So that those scales are more in balance, that she not only knows them with a kind of depth and intimacy, but they begin to feel, oh, I know her too.
So there's a sort of empowerment there for them both to take action at the leave-taking.
Right. Exactly.
On the other hand, people who treat patients for mental illness know from the beginning of the relationship, for the most part, that there will be a point at which treatment ends.
Yes, and psychologists and psychiatrists call this termination.
It's a terrible word,
which is a horrible word from my point of view. But, you know, as soon as you start working with someone in a therapeutic relationship, you are, and they are, in some sense, anticipating an end. I mean, if things get better, and no one gets completely better, right? Mm-hmm. But if the whole idea in therapy is sort of to look at two kinds of exits. One is to help patients exit those abusive relationships, those neuroses, those psychoses, those addictions that have in some ways hampered and distorted their lives. So in some ways, the process of psychotherapy or psychoanalysis is about helping patients exit those old, ancient stories of abuse and addiction and neuroses. But the other, at the same time, psychotherapists are also helping their patients face the ending of the relationship that they're beginning to establish with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of those endings are happening, the endings of the mental illness or the neuroses, but also the ending of this relationship that allowed patients to get better. And so the psychotherapist Linda Gould in this book talks about the ways in which she prepares patients to leave. And the kind of, that in the terminations, as she calls them, are of two kinds. One is that there's a highly structured kind of protocol that she uses with all patients in the last two or three sessions that she has with them. But she also says that each one of these goodbyes are very individualistic,
yeah,
very idiosyncratic, and special to the relationship that she has with each individual patient.
Yeah, I think that's really intuitive on her part, because some of them are maybe not done with therapy, but she's done all for them that she could, and she's sort mm-hmm. of handing them off to another expert. In other mm-hmm. cases, people are better. I think we assume as members of the general public that these terminations are sort of devastating for the patient and no big deal for the therapist, and that's not necessarily always the case.
No. I mean, one of the things that was very interesting to me, I was very curious about as I began the interviews with Linda Gould, the psychotherapist, was what did it feel like for her to be left
mm-hmm.
by her patients? and were there ways in which she had to prepare herself for their departure? And she describes a lot of loss and a lot of sadness as she says goodbye to these folks. And it really requires a kind of discipline, a kind of focus on what the patients need, not what she needs, in order to say a good goodbye to them.
And I guess she has also helped them cope in many cases with exits in their own lives that are not part of the relationship that she has with them.
Right. That's one of the, she's obviously in her practice working with couples who are anticipating or struggling with divorce and are trying to do that in a way that's responsible and that's thoughtful and that's caring. And so one of the things that she's working with all the time with her patients are those kinds of exits that they're actually living through in the therapy sessions and in their lives.
Why do people fear the idea of endings?
Well, I think one is just the kind of cultural experience or framework that I pointed to before, and that is really that we are a culture that's always poised for the next move, ready to seize the next opportunity, tilting towards the future. I always think about our culture as being sort of pyramidal. That is, we're always moving up and we're always ready to make the next move in order to move up and in order to start again. Mm-hmm. And I think there are cultures where where the image is not one of a pyramid or a triangle, but one of a circle, where endings and beginnings kind of merge one with the other, and where we're not so terrified of endings, where we don't see endings as failures. But I think as well that all of these markers in our lives need ceremony. They need ritual.
We'll talk about that in just a moment. My guest is Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, author of the new book, Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free. If you'd like to join the conversation or share a story of your own, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is MacArthur Prize-winning sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. She's Emily Hargroves Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard and author of the new book, Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Sarah, we have graduation ceremonies, we have funerals. We don't necessarily mark other major occasions in our lives. We don't have divorce parties very often. We don't have career change ceremonies. Why do we decide certain things are worthy of exit rituals and others aren't?
Well, that's a very good question. I think in different cultures, different rituals kind of surround moments of transition. And I think in general, in our society, we're very minimalist about these things. And as a matter of fact, you mentioned graduation. Mostly we don't use that word anymore. We say commencement, right? Which just points to the fact that we're on to the next thing, commencement, beginnings,
right. Rather
than marking graduation. So I think it's part of that sort of sense that exits are retreats. And the only one that I think of that many families and don't pay this much attention to it, but the only kind of exit I think of is the final exit of death, where usually there is some kind of established ceremony. But the other kind of goodbyes are not so clearly marked. I remember standing in the train station at St. Petersburg in Russia and watching a young family saying goodbye and bye to its the parents, the grandparents at the train station, and there was so much drama and so much talk and so much hand-waving and so much storytelling. I mean, this was a moment of excitement and sorrow and drama, and I thought, I remember at that moment, that this is a culture that knows how to say goodbye, right?
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is that I talk about in this book is that I really do believe that there's some relationship between these sort of ordinary, daily, kind of micro goodbyes and our capacity to learn how to manage and cope with and move through the larger goodbyes that really shape our life journeys and rock our worlds. And I don't think that we as parents or teachers in schools help children learn how to say goodbye in those very small, ordinary moments each day. Again, that's not part of the socialization of our children.
And another thing you write about that I think I had never considered before is that the way we are connected now by social media and technology has really changed the nature of what goodbye means. I have friends that I haven't seen in person since I was 13 years old that I can be in contact with on a daily basis.
That's right. I mean, I think the whole game gets changed with cyberspace and with the opportunities for saying both goodbye and hello, and how the meanings of those words change. I mean, our whole identity shifts through cyberspace, or the meaning of friendship, the sort of boundaries between us and the bridges between us shift. So, I think that one of the reasons it's useful now to think about exits is partly because they're being transformed so clearly and quickly in front of our eyes by technological innovation.
What do you think is the difference, Sarah, between an exit ritual or ceremony that really fulfills its purpose and one that for whatever reason seems to ring hollow?
Well, you know, rituals, I think, are always double-edged. I mean, they can be structures that really allow people that are kind of empty in their meaning. They just are kind of practices that have no essence and have no emotion. But the structure of rituals and ceremonies can also be a place where we can express what are always the sort of paradoxical sensations of our exits. This sort of feeling of loss and liberation, this feeling of joy and pain, this feeling of heaviness and relief that are very much at the center of our leave-taking. And rituals allow us to embrace those contradictions. And often, I think, through artistic expression, through music, through song, through dance, through prayer, through poetry, we can experience again these contradictions in our feelings that are we're less able to do if we're sort of just talking in the sort of rational, cognitive, literal way we often talk when we're saying goodbye.
1-800.
So we need the surround of ceremony.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now to Fernando in Dallas. Hi, Fernando.
Hi, Chris. Just had a quick comment. And seeing what your guest had her thoughts on the comment. I've been through several relationships and obviously breakups that followed. But an important part of the breakup to me was knowing that I had to realize that there was that silver lining, you know. I had to learn from those experiences not to commit those same mistakes. But also what was important was to essentially find a new hobby, find something else that would, enhance the quality of life. And that's actually how I started scuba diving and much later skydiving. So I wanted to see what your guest thought about, gaining new life experiences after these traumatic experiences.
That's really interesting. Thanks for your call.
Yes, I think that's a lovely insight that one of the things when you're experiencing these losses and this need to move on, that it's important to try to find ways of filling that space and creatively. And purposefully, and I think hobbies can do that as well, joining groups And I think doing this in some kind of community is often the ways in which people feel some levels of support in exiting as well.
You have a great story in here of a young man who left his family in Iran to come study in the United States, and that story is told mostly through his perspective. What's interesting to me is that for him, the exit sort of begins when he gets to the airport and realizes he's really going. And yet, I would imagine from the point of view of his parents, his sort of exit from their home began not long after he became a little boy.
That's right, and particularly in war-torn Iran, where the terrain was so dangerous and scary, and where this young Bijan, as a young adolescent, he and his brother were part of that the kind of revolutionary movement, and were in harm's way all the time. So these parents were thinking very, very early, how can I get my son out of this dangerous place, and how can I find a way to help him exit. This is an act of love on my part as a parent.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think about the different kinds of loss and how they were experienced by different members of the family.
Yes. I think that one of the things which Bijan, the young man, felt when he was in the United States, just hungering for home, wanting to be at his mother's bosom, wanting to be back with all that was familiar and good about Iran and about his family. You know, it was he began to have these conversations with his father, which he recognized, begging his father, let me come home. And his father would say, you know, they would play what Bijan called a brain game back and forth, knowing that he was never going to be able to come back. But in some ways, just hearing his voice, his father's voice, made him feel as if he was connecting in with home.
Of all places, the chapter in which humor sort of plays in as a strategy for easing endings and exits, it's the one about ICU physicians.
Right. Yes. Well, it's so amazing to sit there in the ICU watching this attending physician teaching his residents about how to prepare their patients for exiting the extreme environment in which they are. And so there are two exits from the intensive care unit. One, obviously, is the exit to death, and the other is the exit back to the floor of the hospital where a patient will continue, we hope, to get better. And this is a really intense, charged environment where every decision is life-threatening. Every decision has huge consequences, life or death consequences. And so the residents and the interns are always looking to reduce the kind of stress that they're under as they're making these minute-by-minute decisions. And the attending physician recognizes that there is need for humor from time to time to reduce the stress. But he's very quick to say that we don't want that humor to be the gallows humor where, in some ways, which often doctors engage in, or that the humor degenerate into laughing at patients or making fun of them. But it be a kind of a self-deprecatory humor, a humor which recognizes we are all fallible people, we make mistakes, and to sort of look at some of those mistakes that didn't have such dire consequences as sources of humor.
I felt great empathy for the students who suddenly have sort of matriculated to the point at which they are making at least some of these life or death decisions. And although they've worked so hard for this, when they get there, they think, wait, I want someone else to decide this. It's too much.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that this attending physician says is that they have to learn courage. Mm-hmm. And courage, he says, is not the absence of fear. It is what we do to combat the fear. And so that part of what he's teaching them is not only the science of this and the clinical medicine of this and the diagnoses of the illnesses or the medicines that have to be given, but he's trying to teach them a kind of gravitas, as he puts it, a kind of courage where they own the work and where they're willing to stand by it.
Is there something, Sarah, fundamentally different about exits or endings that literally change our identity from married partner to divorcee or widow, from student to alum, from addict to recovering addict?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a very, I think it's so core to how we think about ourselves, how we measure ourselves, how we judge ourselves, and how we identify ourselves has a lot to do with exiting.
Tell me a little bit about the projects that you've worked on throughout your career. I mean, it seems like each time you pick up a new field of study, it requires an ending to what you've focused your life very intensely on before.
Well, one of the great, I think, parts about the way I have lived my professional research and writing life is that each project is an opportunity to learn something new.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes me to a different place. I need to ask different questions. I need to be attentive and listening. I need to learn, because part of the reason I've chosen this next project is because I really know nothing about it, you know. And so I think that it does require that I exit one thing and move on to the next. But like all of exits, we carry a piece of what we know with us to the next project, to the next identity, to the next role. So as we make an exit, it doesn't mean that we have to leave everything behind and close the door. I don't believe in closure. But rather that many of the sort of traits and skills and experiences and perspectives that we learned in the last chapter can be brought into the new chapter and it becomes integrated into the way we live the new role or the new identity or the new research project.
When you say you don't believe in closure, that's remarkable to me, because people always talk about wanting this, and yet very few people, I would think, actually achieve it, because you're never quite done with something.
No, you're not done with it. And, you know, this is true about, you know, people whose children die, for example, the most painful, difficult, anguished thing that anyone can go through. And when people come up to them and say, when do you think you'll find closure? This is, I remember this from Joan Didion's book, right? This is, you know, these parents look like, are you crazy? There's no such thing as closure. You live with that wound, you live with those scars over time. And it's how you live with them that might shift and change over time, but it's not that they disappear.
MacArthur Prize-winning sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is Emily Hargrove's Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard University. Her new book is called Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free. Sarah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, it has been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think and download the daily podcast at kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.